loud and clear.
From the studios of Radio Sputnik in downtown Washington, D.C., it's Loud and Clear. We take you inside the news 5 days a week. It's happening, and it's happening now. I'm Brian Becker. The Nuclear Security Summit kicks off today in Washington, D.C. World leaders from 56 countries are being hosted by President Obama to discuss the securing of nuclear material. However, noticeably absent this year is Russia. Why is Russia skipping the summit? One of the world leaders present at the summit is China's Xi Jinping, who will meet President Obama one-on-one today in a talk about a range of subjects. The two leaders are expected to discuss the ongoing South China Sea dispute, and the U.S. is also pressuring China to implement additional sanctions against North Korea, the DPRK. Today is Cesar Chavez Day, a commemorative holiday that is celebrated in 10 states in the United States. President Obama called on the day to become a national holiday back in 2008. But just who is Cesar Chavez and what is important about his legacy and the struggles of farm workers and immigrant communities today? But first we turn to the Nuclear Security Summit. We are joined by Andrei Baklitsky. He is the Director of Information Projects at the Moscow-based PIR Center, a think tank dedicated to the problems of nuclear security and defense issues. Welcome, Andrei.
Hi.
Andrei, the National Security Summit kicks off today in Washington, D.C. What's its purpose? Is it a significant gathering?
Well, it definitely is a significant gathering, as you said. Lots of world leaders coming together to a single place to discuss how you best fight nuclear terrorism, how you best you secure nuclear materials, which is in itself a good and noble goal. And frankly speaking, nobody in Russia questions that the general idea of paying more attention to nuclear security is good. But as you know, Russia will not be participating in the summit. And, well, there are some reasons for that, clearly.
Okay, so what are they? I mean, Russia's been there since 2010. That's when these summits started to happen. They've been happening every 2 years. This is the fourth summit, I believe. So why has Russia chosen not to participate? I recognize that they made this decision not at the last moment, so it's not simply situational or conjunctural based on immediate politics. What's the main motivation for Russia's decision not to participate?
Well, from the beginning, there were some issues with nuclear security summits. First of all, it's not a universal thing. It's organized by country which is hosting the summit. They issue invitations to the countries they want to see there, and they do not issue invitations to the countries they don't want to see. For example, as you know, Iran is not a member and was not participating in any nuclear security summit, despite the fact that it has nuclear material, which clearly needs protection and security. So with this, you know, arbitrary approach, there always was this at least feeling that maybe you should transfer this to some place where everybody could participate and engage. But even with this in mind, Russia participated in the first three summits. It was this push towards the bringing more importance to nuclear security and putting it on high alert worldwide. But then, actually, the third summit, which was in Netherlands in 2014, was meant to be the last one and was planned like three summits in a row. But then, at that point, U.S. decided that there's going to be another one in Washington, and it would all be smoothly starting in the United States and ending in the United States. But Russia at that time was already saying that, look, we already got everything we could from the summits. We rose to the awareness, and just simply coming together every 2 years and talking about the same issues is not really moving us forward. So that's not super important at this point of time. And we really want to focus on the IAEA premises. Everybody's present, and we can, you know, discuss the things with everyone, not with the selected group of few. And as this nuclear security summit is the last one, and there's not going to happen another one, pretty much everybody at this summit will be talking about, discussing about what are we going to do next once we are leaving Washington. And one of the answers is clearly, you know, get at IAEA and discuss it with everyone. So Russia pretty much did what everyone will do in Washington. It already decided how it's going to proceed with nuclear security in the future.
So, okay, so the issue before the summits was how to make sure that, I believe, that nuclear products that came from civilian energy programs did not fall into the hands of non-state actors or terrorists. That was an issue of concern for all countries that have any kind of nuclear program, civilian or military. This is about civilian nuclear energy. Is that right, or is this about civilian and military nuclear energy programs?
No. It's only about civilian nuclear programs, because military nuclear programs are very sensitive, and like every country invests all its potential in securing them and making sure that everything is good with them. So the idea is that military nuclear programs do not need further security, because they are like the most secure thing you have in a state. And anyway, people will not really cooperate and not really tell more about how they protect their nuclear security programs. But you're right, peaceful nuclear programs are vast and robust. And we got some anachronisms dating back to the Cold War times and to the 60s, 70s, 80s, when, for example, in research reactors, which are clearly purely peaceful, they were using the highly enriched uranium, the same kind of uranium you can use to make an atomic bomb. And it was used because it was seen as more suitable. It was easier to run the projects you need to run to. But after some time, people started realizing, like, look, those countries which have no military programs, they have, at the moment, highly enriched uranium. So what are we going to do with that? Well, for example, they have nuclear propulsion, the ships which, for example, use also highly enriched uranium to run the reactor. What you do with that? And just so many things are coming up.
It appears, at least when you look at the mainstream media in the United States, here in Washington, D.C., the capital of the United States, that the summit is largely a political event. You have a big focus today on the fact that Xi Jinping is going to be meeting with President Obama. The summit is large part of the media presentation here is that the summit's going to take up the question of the so-called a nuclear threat from the DPRK, the Democratic People's Republic of Korea, or North Korea. Is it political? And is North Korea, as it's being presented here, at least in the media, that the summit is going to take up a nuclear threat? Is North Korea a nuclear threat?
Well, clearly, if you bring together so many leaders of so many countries, you would get some bilaterals and multilaterals and what have you, because like, that's a good opportunity once you're already there. So apart from nuclear issues, there will be discussion of all over the place, people meeting and discussing stuff. And talking, singling out nuclear Korea specifically, North Korea nuclear program specifically, it's not really fair, because the nuclear security summit only deals with nuclear security, which means safeguarding your nuclear materials so they won't be stolen. And that's pretty much it. Non-proliferation, arms control, disarmament have pretty much nothing to do with nuclear security. Those are separate fields. So when the media is covering the nuclear security summit, and they also know that there will be some discussion on DPRK, clearly you add one to one and you got two. But that's pretty much an interpretation of what's going to happen. As Japan, South Korea, China, U.S. all will be present, they'll probably discuss the DPRK issue. There'll probably be some kind of statement. But I really doubt that North Korean issue would directly go into the summit procedures, that it will be somewhere in the resulting documents. So that's probably just one of the things that people will discuss while being in Washington.
Of course, the issue of terrorism is a dominant issue right now in the world. You had the bombing attacks and the terrorist attacks in Paris and Brussels, earlier in Turkey. the downing of a Russian civilian airliner from Egypt. There's been so many military attacks that ISIS or ISIL, Daesh, so-called Islamic State, have claimed credit for. Obviously, Daesh isn't the JV team as President Obama determined it wants to be. It's got a reach. It poses a danger. From your point of view, as an expert in this area, how big of a worry is it that groups like ISIL or Daesh could be obtaining nuclear materials? How big of a deal is it?
Well, clearly there's a concern. If you look at what ISIS doing in Iran, in Iraq and Syria, they're clearly trying to get their hands on weapons of mass destruction. There's no doubt about that. They have chemical weapons, and they've been willing to use them. So if they only could get their hands on some kind of nuclear material, they would probably use it. And we know in the past Al-Qaeda was pretty much clear about their intention to get some kind of nuclear weapon. Again, compared to chemical weapons, nuclear weapons are much more complicated. To produce some kind of chemical weapons, you don't need the most basic type. You don't need such a developed industry to get nuclear weapons. You really have to invest much in that. You need facilities, you need supplies, you need high-tech technology. So to produce a nuclear weapon is probably something without reach of terrorist groups at the moment. So we would be either talking about terrorists getting some kind of access to already made nuclear weapon in some country, which, as I said previously, is also something not really plausible because military nuclear installations are the most heavily guarded facilities in the country. Or they might try to do something which is called a dirty bomb, is when you mix normal explosives, conventional explosives, with radiological material. And then when you made this explosion, the radiological materials, nuclear materials, are being dispersed over some area, depending on kind of material you're using. And that leads to radiological contamination, which is bad. And you wouldn't really want that happening. And it could also induce panic, which is also a big problem, especially that happened in a big city. So that's one thing we should look up to. But again, if you're talking about ISIS, about their core territory in Syria and Iraq, it's pretty much useless to engage in this sort of activities there, because when you're fighting a war, they are fighting now. There's not much of a use. It's a weapon of terror. It's a weapon of a battlefield. And when we're talking about striking somewhere out of their territory, in Europe or in other places, then from what we are seeing, ISIS, it's very keeps doing something simple and effective. So when you can give AK-47 to a group of guys and they'll slaughter a lot of people on the streets of Paris, why would you really care about engaging something like transporting radiological material? But again, if that happens and if that succeeds, there would be a tremendous shock. There will be a lot of problems with letting this happen. And I would just want to stress that never in history there was any act of nuclear or radiological terrorism. And that's probably part of, because it's difficult, but another part is those actions which are moving towards securing nuclear material and not letting this happen ever are sort of, just adding protection to things which are already protected. But again, to do everything they can to not let that happen.
We're talking to Andrei Bakalitsky. He is the director of information projects at the Moscow-based PIR Center, a think tank dedicated to the problems of nuclear security and defense issues. Andrei, we have about 2 minutes left. I want to ask you about the architecture, the post-Cold War so-called architecture of security, of nuclear security. When the Soviet Union was no more 25 years ago, when this former Soviet republics became independent and some of them had nuclear materials, nuclear technologies, nuclear weapons, there was obviously a lot of discussion by the new Russian government and the United States government about post-Cold War issues related to nuclear security. There were arrangements made. What were those arrangements, and have they become outdated?
Well, actually, for the moment, the arrangements which were made during early post-Soviet times are almost over. The majority of them has ceased to operate. But yeah, at that time, that was a big issue because first you have one highly centralized state, the Soviet Union, but all of a sudden you have 15 new states, which some of them lacking basic expertise because the people who are running them are now in Moscow or in other countries, and each would have to have its own specialist on the topic. And you add to that the economic hardships which all of these new republics are facing, and you get a big problem, and there were a lot of, you know, threats coming from all over the places. And you're right, from these 15 republics, four got nuclear weapons on their territory. It was Belarus, Ukraine, Kazakhstan, and Russia. And it was not clear from the beginning that many of them would, you know, withdraw the weapons from their territory. In the case of Ukraine, for some time, it was deciding if it was going to leave its nuclear arsenal or not. And that would be world because you got this new nuclear weapon states, and what you do with them. Luckily, all of them at the end decided to ship their nuclear weapons out of the country. But the issue of nuclear materials remained because you can at least, you know, what kind of weapons you have and where are they. But if you look at the low levels, for example, if you look at the radiological isotopes which are in hospitals, that was already something which was really hard to count, especially with the system of intergovernmental interstate exchanges pretty much disorientated for the moment. And then if you have those facilities, you have to safeguard them, and you don't have enough people, you don't have enough technology, you don't have enough money to do that. At the time, the United States was very helpful in helping to secure those facilities, those materials. But again, well, everybody was acting in its own interest because neither United States nor a newly built Russian Federation were interested in any kind of nuclear or radiological materials getting into the hands of terrorists. So combining this self-interest from each of the parties, there was programs such as Mann-Lugar program, the nuclear threat reduction program. These programs were helpful in helping Russia at that particular point of time. But since then, more than 15 years passed, and the Russian Federation is pretty much capable to secure its nuclear facilities on its own.
Okay, we've been talking with Andrei Baklitsky. He's the Director of Information Projects at the Moscow-based PIR Center, a think tank dedicated to the problems of nuclear security and defense issues. Thank you, Andrei. You are listening to Loud and Clear. We'll be back.
Loud and Clear. Loud and Clear.
You are listening to Loud and Clear. I'm Brian Becker. Chinese President Xi Jinping is in Washington today. He will meet with President Obama one-on-one. They will talk about a range of issues, including the South China Sea dispute and also the United States' pressure on China to implement additional sanctions against North Korea, or the DPRK. We are joined by David Ewing. He is the co-chair of the U.S.-China People's Friendship Association in California. Welcome back, David.
Thank you.
President Obama and Xi Jinping meet tomorrow in Washington on the sidelines of the Nuclear Security Summit. What can we expect in that meeting?
You know, what the U.S. has said about this meeting in preparation, I think, is that they're concerned about issues in North Asia, like with the Korean Peninsula, and also with China's claims on the Spratlys and the Paracel Islands in the Pacific. So, you know, the U.S. has, as you know, has been challenging China's sovereignty over these islands, And so that and the Korean Peninsula issue, where the U.S., as you know, today the U.S. is doing really aggressive rehearsals for an invasion of North Korea along the coast in concert with the South Korean Navy. And it's just an extremely dangerous thing for North Korea to have to cope with, and so they're making aggressive threats against their adversaries, the U.S. and South Korea. So there's that thing going on, and there's also this ongoing issue about the Spratlys and the Paracels.
David Ewing, the Xi Jinping visit, any visit by a Chinese political leader in Washington, obviously is making big news. The Washington Post has a front-page headline that says, "Grumbling mounts in China, even in the party. Is President Xi Jinping losing his grip?" I mean, that's the front page. Obviously, the Chinese are looking at that. The Chinese leadership is looking at that. That's on the eve of President Obama's meeting with Xi Jinping. I mean, what's that all about?
This is such an interesting thing. And, you know, whenever you're dealing with politics, you always want to look at the timing of when stories get released. So in the past week or maybe a little longer or so, there has been a letter critical of Xi Jinping that's been on the internet. And it's been widely circulated in China and widely circulated throughout the world. And, you know, I read the letter. It has a lot of the sort of criticisms of Xi, that he's not effective enough on corruption, that, you know, the stock market went down, they handled it badly, the economy is not growing fast enough, kind of the routine things that you hear critical of Chinese government, especially from the U.S. And then, you know, it was unclear whether it was a hoax or whether it was connected to a real political movement. It's all unsigned. There's no one taking credit for it in China. So it's just unclear what it means. But then suddenly, you know, 24 hours before the meeting between Xi Jinping and Barack Obama, it's, you know, front page news on the Washington Post. So it's one of those things that, you know, you have to expect in the realm of international politics where, you know, people have some hostility to China.
The Washington Post article, I want to just stay with this for a moment. I also want to go to the dispute in the South China Sea, what the United States and China's differing positions are on that. But I want to stay with this. The Post article says, "One criticism reported by the Washington Post this month came in the form of a letter by, quote, loyal Communist Party members calling on Xi Jinping, the Chinese president, to resign for gathering too much power into his own hands and provoking a series of political, economic, ideological, and cultural crisis." Of course, as you said, we don't know who the real signers are, and we know that this letter is making its rounds in the media, both here and in China, or on some Chinese websites. But the Post goes on, but a second essay was equally explosive because it was posted on the website of the Central Commission for Discipline Inspection, the anti-corruption body that has been at the center of Xi Jinping's efforts to reform the party, eliminate rivals and crush internal dissent. And then it says the CCDI is run by Wang Qishan, generally regarded as Xi's right-hand man. The essay says, quote, "A thousand yes men cannot equal one honest advisor. The ability to air opinions freely and to accept suggestions frequently determines the rise or fall of an empire. We should not be afraid of people saying the wrong things. We should be afraid of people not speaking at all." I mean, of course, it seems the Washington Post is kind of a neoconservative newspaper at this point. But is there an effort underway by Western capitals to kind of create a major division in China? There have been major political splits in the past. That certainly was what led up to the Tiananmen Square crisis in June 1989. I mean, do you think this is a serious effort, both internally and internationally?
First of all, what a breathtaking criticism of China this is. Imagine if the U.S. actually adhered to such principles. Oh, the immense lying that got us into the war in Iraq and, you know, the subsequent wars in Libya and elsewhere, you know, where any kind of dissent was immediately hushed and stopped in the U.S. But anyway, that aside.
That's a good point.
Yeah, but, you know, so, yeah, of course China has to permit dissent within the party so that the authorities can deal with facts instead of just opinions. But I think the background is that The anti-corruption campaign is stinging pretty badly. It's hurting a lot of people. The government really seems, the party seems to be determined to crush it, to break as much of the corruption as they can. And it's popular in China. The fighting the corruption is popular. So, I mean, people are getting stung, and of course, people are going to fight back. They're in the political party. They're going to fight back politically. So, that's why I'm not really dismissive of, whether this is a hoax or not. It might really be real and really, as you seem to imply, reflect strains within the party. Of course, I think there are probably strains within the party, and, we've seen it over, I think there's been some disagreement over attitudes towards the alliance with North Korea and elsewhere. So, I don't have a real take on if there are particular, if there's any organized opposition. I'd have to really, before I were really convinced about the seriousness of these letters, this letter, I'd have to have more information. It just doesn't seem, at the timing of it's a little suspicious right before the meeting that were released by the Washington Post. Yeah.
Well, the timing would seem to be not coincidental, whether it's a hoax or not. Certainly the timing can't be coincidental, because there's never a time as there is when the Chinese leadership meets with the president of the United States, where there's more visibility and more international media attention. David Ewing, I want to turn to another big issue, of course, between U.S.-China relations, and that's sort of what we're talking about, because it involves not just the United States and China. It also involves Japan. Japan and the United States are signing a new security agreement whereby the Abe government in Japan agrees to pay $1.6 billion to house U.S. soldiers in Japan for the continuing occupation of Japan, an occupation that's highly unpopular among the population in Japan. But there's a new news story that says Japan opens radar station close to disputed islands, drawing angry China response. China on Monday switched on a radar station in the East China Sea, giving it a permanent intelligence gathering post close to Taiwan and a group of islands disputed by Japan and China, drawing an angry response from Beijing. Talk about that.
Yeah, there are a couple, maybe 100 or more islands. There are two chains of islands, the Paracel Islands in the northwest, and then the Spratlys, kind of more central, closer to Taiwan. So these have been claimed by China for, hundreds of years, and they have really only become an issue very recently. Whether China's sovereignty over these islands only became an issue really after 1951, after the victory of the People's Government in the Revolutionary War that ended in 1949. So it was only after that time. But going back to the 7th century, China was actually exploring the Paracels and the Spratlys. And then even in the 11th century, they were patrolling it. And then finally, the Emperor Kublai Khan actually had the islands mapped in the year 1279. And so there were always Chinese ships around the area. There were, had people on and off the islands. The Chinese Empire then really controlled the seas, the South China Sea and that part of the Pacific. And there were no challengers. Their other states were much smaller. The first visits, I think, by the Vietnamese were like in the 17th century. So there hasn't been really a big, no one has challenged these claims until really after the Chinese Revolution. And it came up in the context of the settlement of World War II. One of the peace agreement, the finalized peace agreement, was done in San Francisco in 1951. And Japan had, before that, Japan had agreed to give up all the territories it had seized during World War II and earlier. And, of course, one of the territories they seized was the island of Taiwan. So when there's dispute about whether China would get the territories back, by 1951, when the conference happened, the Chinese Revolution had already occurred. And then, by then, the U.S. was backing off, returning everything to China. It was trying to steer things so that Taiwan would get control instead of China. And then China was not even invited to the conference, to the peace conference, even though they were a major participant in Asia. So it was because of this sort of anti-communist crusade in the 50s that the U.S. backed off on supporting
David Ewing,
China's right to these islands.
How big of a danger is this in terms of starting a regional confrontation, a bilateral confrontation between Japan and China? And given the fact that the United States, since President Obama announced the Asia pivot when he was in Australia, has determined that by 2020, 60% of the U.S. Navy and Air Force assets will be placed into the Pacific, given those facts, could the disputed islands issue become a flashpoint for a larger confrontation?
Yeah, of course. But, you know, how does one settle such disputes? You know, there is a United Nations Law of the Sea treaty that governs, that President Obama says governs the who gets those islands, who has control of those islands. And under those provisions, the fact that the Chinese have had control over them, they seem to have by far the strongest claim under the Law of the Sea conference that everybody cites. Interestingly, one of the few countries in the world that refused to sign the Law of the Sea agreement was the United States of America. So it's a little bit.
And why was that? Help the audience understand, why did the U.S. not sign the treaty?
The U.S. does not recognize the right of generally, the U.S. has avoided recognizing the rights of international bodies to affect the American political system or to affect American rights around the world. That's generally been the reason that many international treaties, like the International Criminal Prosecution Treaties, were not signed by the United States. The United States sort of claimed an exceptional position that they don't want to be governed by international law.
So maybe that's what they mean by American exceptionalism. You, the rest of the world, should be governed by international law, but we, the exceptional, the indispensable United States, we just have free reign. We're the 700-pound gorilla. We sit wherever we want to.
Now, you know, if the U.S. suppose the U.S. had agreed to be under the jurisdiction of the International Criminal Court, I think, you know, victims of, you know, torture or repression of foreign countries could bring actions against the United States in that court. And then the U.S. is a party, so it's dangerous for the U.S. to accept jurisdiction, right? And I think the U.S. might have the same problem with the Spratly Islands. If they accept, you know, if they really do adhere to join the treaty, then they're bound to all the decisions made by the treaty and by people who are deciding the fate of those islands. And because China has the strongest claims, it's not something the U.S. maybe wants to do. So, yes, these can be a flashpoints, but they are artificial flashpoints because although other countries have claims to these islands, it looks like pretty much China has the ancient, well, you know, they had claims that were not challenged until very recently.
David Ewing, we have about 1 minute. I want to ask you real quick, because there is only a minute. The U.S. is trying to pressure the Chinese government, and obviously, as you mentioned in the beginning, there are some sections of the Chinese political establishment that are willing, it seems, to forego their historic relationship with the DPRK. Where does Xi Jinping stand on that, do you think?
You know, I think one of the issues today is that the Americans are saying that the Chinese are not pressing the sanctions hard enough. So what does that mean? You know, it looks like, you know, China agreed to pretty severe sanctions, but now the U.S. is complaining that the Chinese are not executing the sanctions with the amount of vigor the U.S. thinks is really required. So there's one issue. Maybe it means that, you know, China is not as aggressively enforcing the terms of the restrictions as the U.S. would like.
Yeah, I think we're going to have to leave it there. We'll talk again with David Ewing. He is the co-chair of the U.S.-China People's Friendship Association in California. We've been talking about Xi Jinping's visit to Washington, D.C. and his meeting with President Obama. You are listening to Loud and Clear. We'll be back.
Loud and Clear. Loud and Clear.
Today is Cesar Chavez Day, a commemorative holiday that is celebrated in 10 states in the United States. President Obama called on the day to become a national holiday back in 2008. It's not yet. Just who was Cesar Chavez and how important is his legacy and the struggles he represents today? We are joined by Arturo Rodriguez. He is the president of the United Farm Workers of America. Welcome, Arturo Rodriguez.
Brian, thank you very much, and it's a real honor to be on your show today.
Well, it's a great honor for us to have you. Thank you so much. For those who may not know, certainly for our international audience who may not have heard of Cesar Chavez, who was Cesar Chavez and why is he celebrated even to this day?
Well, Cesar Chavez was a farm worker. He was, you know, born and raised in Yuma, Arizona, back in the 1927 when he was born. And his family lost their farm during the Depression days. And so they became migrant workers. And his father took them, brought them to California to begin harvesting the crops. And at that time, Cesar was around the eighth grade. And so he had to leave school and begin helping support the family and, you know, be able to work in the fields. And they worked in all different kinds of crops up and down the state of California and some in Oregon. And for many, many years until he decided that based on all the injustices and the discrimination that took place while he was working in the fields, he decided, you know, in 1962 that it was time that somebody stood up and was willing to take action. So he, along with his wife, Helen Chavez, and Dolores Huerta, and many others, began to do the work that was necessary to talk to farm workers about building an organization where they could bring about changes and improvements for their life and for their families.
The United Farm Workers Organization, the union, was one of the main figures, main forces, main sort of cause celebre in the 1960s and 1970s, along with Dr. Martin Luther King and the Southern Christian Leadership Conference and the struggle for black freedom, the struggle for the Civil Rights Act. You had a predominantly immigrant workforce, predominantly Latino, I would say, being organized by Cesar Chavez, not only for union rights, but for social and civil rights. That really became sort of a galvanizing force for progressive people throughout the United States and led to the first contracts for farm workers. You're the president today of the United Farm Workers Union of America. Talk about the state of farm workers today. Are conditions as bad? Have they gotten worse? Are they better? Talk about that today. What's going on?
Well, certainly, Brian, over the last 50 years, we've made major and significant improvements to the conditions that exist for farm workers in the fields. For example, you know, we've gotten now to ensure that there's bathrooms in the fields for both the women and the men when they're picking the crops there. There's portable drinking water and it's cool and so forth that workers can drink and they don't have to go and get it out of the nearby streams or the or rivers or from hoses and things of that nature. There, last year, we were able to get in the state of California the best protections for farm workers in relationship to heat exposure. Because too often that there are deaths that occur in the fields when the temperatures rise into the 90s and to the hundreds and so forth, and workers are working out there with not enough drinking water, breaks, or shade to take rest breaks and things of that nature. And so we changed the laws to be able to have that, and we've been working on an aggressive enforcement program that exists here throughout the state to eliminate further deaths as a result of heat exhaustion. And the issue of pesticides, you know, this last year we were able to work with the President Obama's administration and the Secretary of EPA, Gina McCarthy, or the Administrator of EPA, to be able to ensure that farm workers are going to be covered under the same regulations that apply to other workers that work with, that apply pesticides and pesticide regulations and so forth, and the protections there. So we've made a lot of gains throughout the years, but there's still so much to be done because farm workers have been discriminated against and been definitely suffer from the most difficult conditions that anybody would want to face in terms of working out in agricultural communities. So despite the gains that we've made, Brian, we know that there's still a lot of work to be done, and that we continue to do that. And we continue to do it with a lot of support from folks throughout the nation and throughout different parts of the world as we look towards how do we help farm workers not only here in the United States, but beyond the borders of the United States and other countries.
Yeah, it's really amazing. I mean, the United States is the richest country in the world, at least richest in terms of the richest people. Not all the people are the richest people, certainly. The farm workers feed the nation, and they feed other parts of the world as well. And their conditions are so difficult. When Cesar Chavez was trying to originally organize workers to get collective bargaining agreements, the conditions in the fields were so difficult, let's say, and much more difficult than, say, organizing workers in a factory or a large-scale place where many, you know, thousands are concentrated together. He introduced the idea of the boycott. There was the boycott of grapes, the boycott of lettuce. I myself went every Saturday morning organizing in Rochester, New York, picket lines at supermarkets that didn't have the union lettuce or the union grapes. And those picket lines were every week for years, actually. Now, it seems to me that in a way, the farm workers still face the same problem. They need solidarity. They need support from other people. What is the United Farm Workers of America doing? What is the union doing to generally galvanize solidarity? Because people do want to help farm workers and realize the tremendous injustices they face.
You know, Brian, that's an excellent question. I mean, we try to do whatever is necessary to really make ourselves relevant today and to continue to deal with the issues that confront farm workers. And so we've embraced a lot of use of technology and working with farm workers and doing texting programs and Facebook and using internet access and so forth so that we can communicate much more rapidly. We have a number of campaigns that are going on right now that we're currently engaged in. One, where I'm at today, is in Fresno County. We're taking on the largest tree fruit grower here in the United States that employs thousands of farm workers that harvest tree fruits. During the summer, and particularly during the summer months, beginning probably around next in May, that harvest will begin to take place. And we're working with dairy workers that cover all the state of Washington, and we're in Idaho and other places looking at the conditions that face particularly men in those particular situations, because they really discriminate against women. But we've had three workers that have died most recently within the last year in manure lagoons. And what that is that, you know, the waste from the cows is all put in one particular area. And because there's no guardrails put around those lagoons, those particular areas, the workers that are driving the tractors that come close to them end up sliding into those particular areas and as a result are suffocated because of it. And so we have a big campaign that we're engaged in relationship to that. We're working with organizations there in the state of New York in hopes of, for the first time ever, being able to get farm workers there in the state of New York the ability to be able to have the right to organize there and to deal with the issues that they're confronted with and so forth. We were successful, or we're, I should say, in a big overtime, in a big campaign here in the state of California to get farm workers, give them access to overtime after 8 hours work. You know, farm workers were excluded from all of the labor legislation that was passed back in the 1930s. The Fair Labor Standards Act that was passed in 1938, the Wagner Act that gave other workers in the country the right to organize. Farm workers were eliminated from all that legislation. So we have a lot of work to do to try to get farm workers in every state or nationally covered under those same laws and give them the same protections the other workers have here in the United States. So that's why we're engaged in a lot of these campaigns. And we felt very good about applying the pesticide laws and regulations on a national basis for the first time. And we're hopes of doing more of that kind of work as we continue to work with the current president of the United States, President Barack Obama, and hopefully with the future president of the United States as well, that will be also willing and wanting to do something to lift up the standards of farm workers in our nation.
Yeah, it's just really incredible that the 1930s legislation that did so much, that brought Social Security in as a right for people, and some of the other legislation also exempted agricultural workers. I mean, and we see the legacy of that today. It is such an uphill struggle and such an important battle. But that brings me back to the issue of Cesar Chavez himself and the fact that 10 states commemorate his life and his work. And President Obama said in 2008, it should be a national holiday. We know with Dr. Martin Luther King's birthday on January 15th, becoming a national holiday, that meant in the schools, in the communities, everywhere in American society, the story of Martin Luther King was told, retold. Maybe there are different versions of it, but nonetheless, it really made a big difference in terms of public consciousness. How big of a need is it that Cesar Chavez, as the foremost historic leader of the civil rights, economic rights, social justice rights for farm workers, that it be given a national day? And is it possible, do you think?
Well, I definitely think that, you know, all of that, having a national holiday, having state holidays, having commemorations, all of that's important in terms of recognizing and providing role models for our young folks and demonstrating to them that regardless if you're poor, if you don't have access to what other young folks might have, you don't have the economic benefits that others might have. And at the same time, if you're willing to work hard and you're willing to follow your passion and your dreams and so forth, that you can aspire to be, to do great things. And that's what Caesar's life was all about. He was a common person and that tried to do uncommon things. And so I think that's important to really share that with folks. And obviously, you know, having state holidays and in the states that exist right now, there's all kinds of commemorations that take place that we're a part of and that we're not a part of and people are engaged in right now and practicing service to their communities and learning about that and the importance of that. And so we're going to always work towards doing everything we can to make sure that people understand what were the beliefs, what were the values of Caesar, and how did that affect me, and how can I utilize that? How can that benefit my family, my community, and what I need to do with my own life in terms of helping those that are less fortunate than I am and working with them and so forth? And so, you know, I don't know that we'll see a national holiday anytime in the near future, but certainly it is something to continue to strive for, just as it is to be able to continue to do the work that we do and engage people throughout the United States and in other countries who we're working at so that they can do their own part, whatever it might be. The boycott was a beautiful way of getting people to do a very simple thing, and that was to not buy a product. And in this particular case, you know, we constantly look towards ways that people can do something very small, but yet it has a super impact in terms of bettering and improving the lives of farm workers in their communities.
We're talking to Arturo Rodriguez. He is the president of the United Farm Workers of America. We're talking about Cesar Chavez on Cesar Chavez Day. In our last 2 minutes and 15 seconds, Arturo, I want to just ask you about the impact this has on farm workers and your communities. We have Donald Trump going around the country getting a lot of support, and he says, let's build a wall at the U.S.-Mexico border. Let's make it a big wall. Let's make Mexico pay for it. And it becomes a rallying cry against immigrant people, the demonization of immigrants, using immigrants as a punching bag, really, for political purposes. What's its impact on farm workers? Just tell me, is the community, are the people you're working with, alarmed by this kind of thing?
Well, I think that farm workers are like anyone else. When they hear someone like Donald Trump that could potentially become president of the United States and hear the viciousness of his words and the violence that he tries to incite among people and divide people and instead of creating unity and so forth, that, yeah, we're alarmed. We're alarmed, but at the same time, it motivates us to want to go out and even do more than what we have been doing. And so we're engaged in during this time of honoring Caesar, we do marches in many different farm worker communities throughout the state and throughout the country. And so I'm going to be in Salinas, California on Sunday, where I know that we're going to have thousands of people there. And people are going to be chanting Chavez C and Trump no. We're going to be communicating that message to everyone to make sure that people go out and, first of all, if they can, that they become citizens here in the United States. Secondly, that they register to vote, and that they get everyone in their community and their families and so forth engaged in that process. And for those that are not able to become citizens, they can still go around and talk to people and knock on doors and motivate folks that do have that particular right. So we're very much motivated that to do something in support of folks like Secretary Hillary Clinton, that really does support the issues that confront farm workers, that are important to farm workers. We had a meeting with her a few weeks ago with our farm worker leadership, and she made it very clear that she is going to come out and support immigration. She's going to continue to work with us as she has in the past. And the leadership was really inspired, motivated by her words and her actions there that particular day. So we're ready to go out and do whatever we need to do to make sure that a person like a Donald Trump doesn't become president of this country. And we're certainly inspired and motivated to go out and do that, because we know what it takes to advance our communities in the best way possible.
That's all the time we have. We want to thank Arturo Rodriguez. Be sure to go to our Facebook page, Loud and Clear with Brian Becker, for daily updates. If you enjoy the show and want your friends to hear it, let us know by liking the page on Facebook. Remember, telling the truth is important, but to make a difference, it has to be loud and clear. We are out of here.
Loud and Clear.